From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Hillary Clinton campaigns today in the critical state of Ohio with a focus on the economy. Donald Trump was in Virginia earlier today and told a veterans group that the U.S. military is depleted. He did not mention this weekend's big story about his tax returns, which broke just before Saturday Night Live was parodying the first debate.
He hasn't released his tax returns, which means he's either not that rich,
wrong,
not that charitable,
wrong,
or he's never paid taxes in his life.
Warmer.
Joining us now is NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, for a second there, I thought I was actually listening to the debate.
Right. They did a great job. Alec Baldwin there as Donald Trump. They did a great job. But what we are talking about in the story about his taxes is this New York Times story. They published part of his 1995 tax returns over the weekend, which showed him claiming a loss of more than $900 million that year. And he may have used that one year's losses to avoid paying income taxes for many years after that. Now, the New York Times received these tax returns anonymously by mail. What do they tell us about Donald Trump and his finances?
Well, you know, like you said, it was really just three pages that they received. They were state tax returns from New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, and showed that Trump had paid no federal income taxes that year and had $916 million in losses. You know, that is pretty substantial. This is all carried over losses, not just from that year, which is something that highlights not only what's happened with his businesses and some of the bankruptcies that have gone on, but, you know, the fact that you've got this tax system in which wealthy real estate magnates are allowed to use some of these loopholes to be able to continue to invest and still maintain a certain type of lifestyle so that they're not pulling their money out of various markets.
And Trump surrogate and former mayor of New York, Rudy Giuliani, did the Sunday show circuit yesterday to respond in part to this story from the New York Times. Here he is being asked about it by NBC's Chuck Todd.
Look, it's all legal. Should it be?
That's a good question, but it is, and it was, and we're talking about 21 years ago, and if he didn't take advantage of it, he would have been sued. And that's why maybe somebody doesn't want to put out their tax returns, because somebody will distort it that way. I mean, the reality is, he's a genius.
He's a genius, which is a word also used yesterday by Chris Christie, another Trump surrogate. Does this matter to voters?
Well, I mean, this is the spin coming out of after this tax returns were released. And, you know, calling him a genius one way or another, you know, it's he used what was legal to try to maintain his level of wealth. And the accountant that the New York Times tracked down who had signed these papers, who'd verified this, actually said that Trump was not all that involved, that Ivanka asked far more questions than he did, and he asked far fewer questions than his father, Fred, who this accountant had worked for many years as well. So Donald Trump, by all accounts, didn't necessarily look like he was all that involved. So to say he's a genius when it comes to taxes, I don't know, maybe his accountant is.
Meanwhile, we've had a lot of polls come out now since the first debate last week, and they have offered some pretty good news for Hillary Clinton. What do you make of the polls that have come out and the bump that it appears she's getting?
Yeah, clearly in the states, you've seen a little bit more of a widening where there had been a bit of inching toward a tie. The battleground map has always been more favorable to Hillary Clinton and any Democrat because it shows a little bit of a more – there are a few more paths to 270, the number of electoral votes needed. And Donald Trump certainly has had a narrow path that was seeming to open that now looks like it could be closing down if these kinds of news stories continue to come out. And the difficulty after that debate certainly show that some of those people who might have been leaning his direction now moving back toward Hillary Clinton again.
But now we're in October and the phrase October surprise comes up. You've been writing about this. Could there be one? Does it matter?
You know, that's a key question when it comes to these comes to October surprises. A lot of people talk about October surprises as if they could be the big thing that winds up throwing an election. But when you look back in history, it actually turns out that there are far more, you know, it's almost like a creation of an anxious mind more than anything else. It goes back to 1980, even in some parts of the elections in 1968 and 1972. But there are very few few October surprises, quote unquote, that seem to have thrown an election, that, you know, there were other elements, other fundamental elements of that election that had actually mattered far more.
That's NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. And now we know what Domenico's ringtone is. Domenico, thank you.
Sorry.
Amnesty International is accusing the Sudanese military of using chemical weapons against the people in Darfur. The human rights group says more than 200 people, many of them children, have been killed this year, but it cannot document the exact nature of the chemicals involved because the area is extremely remote. The BBC's Anne Soy is following the story from Nairobi in Kenya. And Anne, first of all, tell us more about these claims made by Amnesty International. What are they saying?
Very shocking claims that they have made. This is the first time we are hearing of such attacks in Sudan. Darfur has been in the news for years because of the instability there, but this is the first time we're hearing of allegations of chemical weapons. So Amnesty International says that it interviewed more than 200 people and used satellite images to discover what they called horrific evidence of people who had been subjected to chemical attacks.
Chemical attacks, and what manner of evidence do they have?
From the witnesses that they spoke to and the pictures that they took, they say that the people were complaining that after the Sudanese forces had flown over their area, which is called Jebel Mara in Darfur, some people complained of unnatural smelling gas, and they also complained about vomiting blood. Their skin fell off. Apart from that, they had several symptoms that were characteristic, according to experts, of a chemical attack. And this led Amnesty International to conclude that there has been evidence, compelling evidence, of chemical attacks. And they're saying there have been at least 30 of those in the area.
Huh, at least 30. Has there been any reaction or response to this allegation from the Sudanese government?
The Sudanese government denied those allegations. They said that the Amnesty International report was utterly unfounded, and that the government forces had not used any chemical weapons in Darfur. However, we've seen that the French government has asked for independent international investigations into these claims in Darfur.
Mm. Now, Anne, was it known prior to these allegations whether the Sudanese government or the Sudanese military even had chemical weapons?
No, it actually came as a shock to many because we are used to hearing reports of the people of Darfur being under attack, in some cases by government forces, in other cases by militia who are allegedly sponsored by the state. But this is the first time there has been evidence of allegations of the use of chemical weapons in the area. And so international observers have termed this as very worrying.
Hmm. Well, I mean, as you mentioned, Anne, Darfur has been in the global consciousness for so long now, many years. I mean, there was a rallying cry at one point in time to save Darfur, to end the conflict. And the International Criminal Court has charged Sudan's president with genocide, did so in 2010. And the United Nations even deployed a peacekeeping force. It sounds as if the sum total of these efforts hasn't been enough, if these allegations are true, to bring any kind of lasting peace to Darfur.
Indeed, in spite of those efforts that you have said from the international community, the ICC charging the president, we have seen that the African Union, for instance, has been very keen to protect him. He hasn't been prosecuted. He hasn't been arrested in spite of there being an arrest warrant against him. He has traveled to several African countries, even countries that are member states of the International Criminal Court, and he was not arrested there. Case in point is South Africa, and there was a case that was brought against the government there for failing to arrest President al-Bashir. So given that nothing has really been done legally against any government official with regard to atrocities that have been committed against the people of Darfur in the previous years, there isn't really much hope that anything is going to change now. So it will very much depend on the international community. How else are they going to deal with the government of Sudan to try and bring hope to the people of Darfur? And this is an area that is very difficult to access for anyone, including international organizations. And the government only grants access to very specific areas. And so even gathering that evidence is very difficult. Amnesty International spoke of difficulties in collecting the information that they were able to put together in this report. So it's a very difficult terrain to work in. It's a very difficult context, even for investigators.
Well, that's the BBC's Anne Soy speaking to us from Nairobi about allegations made by Amnesty International that the Sudanese government may have used chemical weapons in Darfur. Anne, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
How much do you have saved? Well, if you're like most Americans making less than $50,000 a year, you have either nothing saved or very little. That's according to a recent survey from the financial services site Go Banking Rates. And even at higher income levels, half of those making in the low six figures had less than $1,000 in their savings accounts. Joining us now, as she does each Monday, is Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So does that surprise you that so many people haven't saved anything?
No. I mean, and part of the idea around savings is that you actually have to proactively do something. So it wouldn't be surprising for us to know that a lot of Americans are a little bit overweight or maybe don't eat perfectly and don't go to the gym that much. This is a little different because a lot of people just still struggling coming out of the recession, and it's taken 5, 6, 7 years just to get back on their feet. Now at a moment, though, where perhaps they may have a little extra cash flow, part of the reason being that gas prices are very low, what we need to do is to retrain them to get into the habit of savings.
Well, and I'm sure that when they hear that, they'll think, oh, this is so stressful. You know, I'm one of the people that doesn't have anything saved right now. This is terrible for me and my future. What am I supposed to do? So besides just getting stressed out, what should somebody do if they haven't saved anything and they want to start saving?
I think you start small. So first you identify some amount of money that you could actually save. You know, when we see these surveys, they're done, whether they're for retirement or the emergency reserve, there's always a question that's buried in there, which is, you know, you don't have any money. If you really tried hard, could you save $5, $10, $15, $20 a week? And the numbers are resounding. People say, of course I could. So what you need to do is just come up with some amount of money and start. And then we need to help you automate it. It was awfully difficult to, you know, make money, pay your bills, then whatever's left over, which is usually nothing, you try to save. But if you do it the other way, which is you pick some amount of money, maybe it's 20 bucks a week or maybe it's 10 bucks a week, and you automatically set up a system where money is pulled out of your checking account and put into a savings account or put into a retirement account, then you are going to end up figuring out how to live on what's left. And that's really the key, to automate the process and make sure the money never hits your hands so you don't spend it.
And put it in a savings account? That's what you would recommend people do?
You know, I was just having this conversation with somebody who said, you know, it was a younger person, like 28 years old. I've just paid off all of my student loan debt, and now I want to start investing in stocks. And I shook him and said, are you out of your mind? Because there are steps that you take before you get to investing. And the first part is that what I just described, like you pay off your debts. And the best thing that I've seen in my previous life as a financial planner is the people who had a lot of debt ended up being fantastic savers, because all they did was they said, well, I used to have $150 a month going to my student loan. They just took that $150 and redirected it. So you pay down your debt. Step two, establish an emergency reserve fund, which is a boring thing, a checking, a savings, a CD. And what you're trying to do is to accumulate, you ready, 6 to 12 months of your living expenses in a very safe place. Does that sound like a lot to you or a little to you?
It sounds like a lot to have 6 to 12 months of living expenses saved up.
Yeah. And the reason why I say that is it's hard to come up with money fast if something unexpected were to occur. For most people, you're really just one bad story at your company away from maybe being downsized. So I would rather err on the side of being a little more conservative. I think that was a lesson that actually paid tremendous dividends for people who were able to do it coming into the financial crisis.
And what if you are nearing retirement and you have very little saved? What should you do at that point? Is the advice different?
I think that for a lot of the people who are coming into retirement, what they'll generally have in my experience is they'll have some retirement account somewhere kicking around. The bigger concern that we have is that people who actually have plans at work, they do save for retirement. But the key is having one. And so many of us don't work at an employer where there is a retirement plan. Now, the good news is that the government actually has a solution to that, and it's called the MyRA. And the MyRA is a way for people who don't have access to an employer plan to either do payroll deduction or have money sucked out of their checking account, sent to a retirement account. It kind of looks like a Roth IRA. It's invested in only one option, which is a very boring treasury bond-like investment. Doesn't pay a lot, but it gets you going. It gets you in the direction. And I think that's a terrific way to put small dollars to work. It's like literally has like peanuts for fees. You can put as little as $5 a week into this thing. You know, ideally you work at a place that has a pension plan. Not so many of those left around. Next bet, you've got an employer who has a retirement plan. You don't have that. Go to the government plan, the MyRA. Go to MyRA.gov.
And we'll link to that at hereandnow.org as well. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always.
Great to be with you.
Well, there's Hollywood, of course, and Bollywood, too. And now there's Yollywood. Atlanta, Georgia is becoming known as the Hollywood of the South. The state has a robust $2 billion film industry, and that means there's a demand for actors, producers, technicians, and stunt people. So much demand that a veteran stunt driver opened up a school there. Two reporters with Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting recently visited the school for a crash course in stunt driving.
Hi, I'm Taylor Gant.
And I'm Sean Powers.
And a few weeks ago, we were in Dawsonville, Georgia, about an hour and a half north of Atlanta.
We met this guy named Robert Dillman, who puts us in a bit of a predicament.
So what you guys are going to do is you're going to stand back to back, feet together, arms down at your side.
Robert Dillman is one of the instructors at Bobby Orr Motorsports.
He's teaching us a lesson in stunt driving, and we're helping out as the props.
Bobby's going to come in fairly high speed. He's going to do a precision drift around you. He's going to start a little wider, closely cut into your feet. Obviously, it's important not to move.
Okay.
We do have a few rules. If you feel unsafe at any time, you can raise your hand and he'll stop.
Okay.
By the end of this, he's going to be so close that when he stops, you guys can both sit on the car.
And this is 100% success rate. No one's been delimbed yet.
Absolutely.
All right, let's do this thing then.
Okay, if we don't make it through this, I want my family to know I love them so much.
So, to set the scene, Sean and I are standing back-to-back in the middle of a stunt-driving obstacle course while a car does donuts a few inches away from our toes.
And the man behind the wheel?
My name is Bobby Orr. I own Bobby Orr Motorsports, also known as BOMS. We're up here at AMP, Georgia, looking to teach all we can.
Bobby Orr is a veteran stuntman and the lead instructor of this stunt-driving school. He started out on the West Coast, but this year opened a program in Georgia in response to the state's booming film industry.
Bottom line is, you know, there's a lot of business here in Georgia right now, a lot of new people and all that, and some of them haven't had the chance to go to a school and get training and all that. So we offer that training, and we're probably the hardest school out there, but at the same time, we turn out some good product.
Orr has trained a number of high-profile Hollywood talents over the years, and he's performed stunts himself. His credits include being John Malkovich, the Dukes of Hazzard, and Seabiscuit. But he especially remembers his time with one A-list actor from the hit movie Gone in 60 Seconds about a group that plans a car heist.
Keep it real. Think slow. We should get through it just fine.
Nicolas Cage came out to the school, worked with me in the day, and I was really surprised because he came out there and... initially, to be honest, I thought it was going to be a prima donna kind of a thing because they had a couple of motorhomes for him and all that. That man came there to work. He got there. He asked who was going to be teaching him. It was me. We got in the car. We were in that car until it was time for lunch. And then ate lunch real quick. We got back in that car. He busted his rear end. Hats off to him.
Stars like Nicolas Cage have been a familiar sight here in Georgia. Jennifer Brett covers the film industry in the state. She says studios can't pass up on the financial incentives.
Filming in Georgia is, it just makes dollars and cents for Hollywood. They can get a tremendous tax benefit. And as the industry has come here, the infrastructure has sort of blossomed all around it.
Stunt drivers are one of the groups benefiting from the increased number of film and television productions in Georgia. Atlanta native Max Calder decided to pursue his career behind the wheel in his home state instead of going west.
When I started, the tax incentives just passed here back in 2008, I think they passed. So met some people, and they said a lot of work's starting to come here, so you should stick around, train, get to know people, and get like a foot in the industry here, because it's hard to break in L.A. It takes about, rule of thumb, 5 years minimum to break in, but got lucky and came here at the right time.
And Calder's decision to stay in Georgia has paid off so far. He's worked on big-budget projects like The Walking Dead series, Marvel's Ant-Man, and Furious 7.
And speaking of a payoff, let's return to our personal stunt driving lesson with Bobby Orr and see if we kept all our toes.
Thank you, sir. Are we alive?
We're good, man. We're all good.
Oh, my God. Woo! Yikes!
That was amazing. Thank you.
Now, has that ever not worked out?
I can't answer that.
Okay.
Well, thankfully, stunt car driver Bobby Orr's years of experience paid off, and our feet remain unharmed. Orr hopes his students will produce similar results on movie sets across Georgia.
For Here and Now, I'm Taylor Gant.
And I'm Sean Powers in Atlanta.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. When you cook with fresh, high-quality ingredients, you can tell. Blue Apron creates and delivers pre-proportioned meals with easy step-by-step instructions, all made in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create home-cooked meals. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Today, Dr. Yoshinori Osumi won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his research on how cells break down and recycle themselves. His work helped identify the genes that regulate a fundamental process known as autophagy, which is connected to several neurodegenerative diseases, including ALS and Parkinson's. For more, we're joined by Erica Holzbauer, professor of physiology at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. Dr. Holzbauer, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here and to celebrate this great news.
Well, and tell us what autophagy is exactly and how significant it is to human biology.
So autophagy is known as the process of self-eating. It's a pathway that cells, both yeast, where it was discovered in these breakthrough papers from Osumi, but also mammalian cells use to respond to starvation or cellular stress. But it's also a process by which cells normally respond to anything that would be a dangerous part of their internal environment. So, for instance, if organelles within the cell, something like a mitochondria, is starting to age, autophagy is a process by which the cell can sequester that organelle from the rest, basically isolate it and degrade it, and recycle the contents for further use.
I've seen it described as a cell taking out the trash.
Exactly. So that's good, and it's also a recycling process, so the cell can reuse the contents. But I think the importance in many cases is the ability to get rid of dangerous things that are within the cell, such as an invading pathogen or, like I said, a defective organelle or aggregated protein.
So how does this play out in the real world? How does it help us to know that?
Well, it helps us a lot because recently work has shown that mutations in genes involved in autophagy, such as genes are responsible for rare forms of Parkinson's disease or ALS, are genes that are critical to the autophagy machinery in neurons. So we're learning that this process is critical to keep a neuron alive over the life of a human being. And by knowing that, we can then design therapies that'll go in and specifically, hopefully, disrupt the process when it's going wrong and improve the health of the neuron.
Dr. Osumi did his research on yeast cells. Can yeast really tell us that much about human biology?
Absolutely. That's what's so monumental about his work. In his groundbreaking studies, he showed both that yeast needs this process, but also mammalian cells do. And remarkably, the basic mechanisms of the process are exactly the same. There are interesting differences that we're still exploring in how it happens in yeast versus a mammalian cell. But the fundamental biology is highly conserved, showing both how important the pathway is and how much we need to understand it.
So with all the things that are going on, all the research that's been going on in the field of medicine, what do you think about the Nobel Committee's decision to award the prize to Yoshinori Osumi for his research on autophagy?
I think it's really an ideal choice. It really highlights the importance of this research and shows, again, that research in a basic model organism such as a yeast has broad applications to human health and biology. And it's just beautiful science. So I think it's very well deserved and very exciting.
That's Erika Holzbauer, professor of physiology at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine, talking with us about the Nobel Prize in Medicine, which was awarded today to Dr. Yoshinori Osumi of Japan. Thanks so much for joining us.
Donald Trump spoke at a military and national security event in Virginia this morning. He talked about cybersecurity and military readiness, but he did not talk about the big story from this weekend. That's the New York Times story published Saturday night, which found that in 1995, Donald Trump declared $916 million in losses on his income tax returns, which means that he could have avoided paying federal income tax for up to 18 years. David K. Johnston says there's even more to the story, that Trump may have made more than $80 million in the same deals that allowed him to claim all of those losses. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He teaches tax law at Syracuse University, and his most recent book is The Making of Donald Trump. He joins us via Skype. David K. Johnston, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Well, first of all, let's just go through a couple of the points made in the New York Times piece from this weekend. What do we know about what made up the $916 million in losses that Donald Trump seems to have declared in 1995?
Well, my former colleagues at the New York Times did an incredible job with this story, but they didn't explain to you the why, and I can do that. There are little clues buried in the three one-page tax summaries, and what they make clear is that Donald had ordinary losses, not capital losses as an investor, but ordinary losses from running his business. And the numbers are consistent with what happened during the collapse and reorganization he went through in 1990, which I covered at the time. So then the issue becomes understanding how he was able to use these losses, because they grew from mismanagement of his businesses and losing money in the businesses and the failure of the Trump shuttle. But they also grew from banks writing down loans. You remember Mr. Trump on the campaign trail has said, I borrowed money knowing I wouldn't have to pay it back, which suggests that he borrowed the money never intending to pay it back.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let me ask you, and again, the U.S. tax code is incredibly complicated. So,
oh, is it?
So, I mean, I'm curious. These are losses that were incurred by Trump's businesses, which would have showed up on the tax returns filed by his businesses. How do they pass through to him as an individual?
Because Donald's businesses were all what are called pass-through entities. So Donald has these losses in his businesses. At the moment, he has over 500 of them, and they pass through to his personal tax return. Now, the problem that he faced is that when the banks lowered his loans, that is, they said, you can pay us back less money than we owe, that's normally taxable income, as a lot of people with home mortgages and student loans they can't pay off have been discovering in recent years. So how did Trump get around this to live tax-free? Well, this is what the New York Times didn't explain. He made use of Section 108 of the Internal Revenue Code, which has a special rule for real estate, and what he did was forego the right in the future to depreciate the other buildings that he owed up to the amount of the forgiven debt and other losses in return for having no immediate tax bill. Then in 1995, he created a publicly traded company with stock, Trump Casino Hotels and Casino Resorts. And they took over the buildings that Trump had agreed not to depreciate the value of them in the future, which made them a lot less valuable. The company then did very poorly. It lost over $1 billion in the 13 years Trump was chairman, and it lost money every year he was there. But Trump got himself paid over $82 million during those years, so he did very well.
So, David, let me just reiterate, because in real estate, it's popularly believed that depreciation is where, you know, some of those great tax advantages come from having the real estate. But he said, according to you, that Donald Trump's agreed to not have all these vast holdings be able to be depreciated, then put those into a publicly traded company so that the shareholders of that company would then not enjoy the benefits of that depreciation. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And by doing this, he succeeded in not owing tax on the loans that were forgiven against his various properties by the bankers. So this was a multi-step process over a period of 5 years in which, in essence, Trump came out as well as he possibly could, didn't have to pay back the loans, didn't have to pay taxes, transferred the tax obligation to these buildings, which he then put into the publicly traded company that performed very badly, while he was paid $82 million as the company failed.
So
pretty good move.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask, what does that say about Trump as a businessman or his accountants? I mean, it sounds like a good deal.
Well, one of the major points I make in my book, The Making of Donald Trump, is that Trump is not the business success he presents himself to the world as. And I show how he mishandled the gambling business. He mishandled individual gamblers. He, when asked under oath about a basic financial concept that my graduate business and law students could answer at the snap of a finger, his answer was gibberish, just like his answer in the presidential debate when he was asked by Hugh Hewitt about the nuclear triad, and he clearly had no idea what the nuclear triad was. Trump is a salesman, and he does a particular kind of deal over and over and over again. And the deal is, I get guaranteed money, and I get money up front, and I don't invest any money, and you take the risk.
Mm-hmm. Everything that you've just said is legal. It's they're completely, it's aspects of the tax code that are there to be exploited for people with the means to do so.
The real scandal about our tax system is indeed that it has special favors for people in real estate, private equity, hedge funds, movie stars, executives, various other folks that in many cases let them pay little or no tax legally. That's the reason that my next project, the one I set aside to write this book about Trump, is that I'm literally drafting an entirely new federal tax code for the 21st century economy.
Now, David, you've also done your own deep independent reporting about Trump's tax returns even in earlier years. You found that, in the 70s, he also did not pay taxes, and also in the 80s, and you found this through court records?
Well, court records and New Jersey Casino Control Commission records. The last year that we actually know Trump paid taxes was 1977, and we know he didn't pay income taxes in 78, 79, 84, 91, and 94. And we also know in the last several years he's reported an income of less than $500,000 because of a special New York State tax benefit that he got.
And that tax benefit comes automatically, right?
A computer looks at your tax return, and if the last line of the front page of your tax return, known as adjusted gross income, is less than $500,000, the computer then cuts you a check for about $300. And Trump got this year after year, and he's tried to offer a sort of cockamamie explanation that makes no sense whatsoever. We also know one other important issue that I dug up earlier this year. There are badges of fraud on his 1984 tax return. Trump filed something called a Schedule C. That's what you do when you have a side business. That's what I do with my writing and lecturing business. And on it, he, for 1984, he reported zero income and over $600,000 of expenses. And I know you'll be shocked to hear that the auditor spotted this and said, please justify the expenses. He couldn't do so, but he appealed anyway. So there were two tax trials, the city of New York and the state of New York. In one of these trials, the judge showed the tax return to Donald Trump's longtime tax preparer, the man who prepared the returns the New York Times got a hold of, Jack Mitnick. And Mitnick testified, that's my signature, but I didn't prepare that tax return. That's a pretty strong indication of fraud. And given that we know Donald Trump participated in a sales tax fraud, where Mayor Ed Koch said he should have served 15 days in jail for it. I think we should treat with suspicion Donald Trump's returns if he won't show them to us, and wonder whether he played strictly by the rules or he bent them or even broke them to benefit himself.
Hmm. Well, David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author of The Making of Donald Trump. We'll link to his latest article about Trump and his taxes from the Daily Beast. We'll link to that at hereandnow.org. David K. Johnston, thank you so very much.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
There's also this news that the New York Attorney General has issued a notice of violation to the Donald J. Trump Foundation, ordering it to stop fundraising activities in the state immediately. The Washington Post reported last week that the foundation never obtained the certification required by the state of New York before soliciting money from the public. So Attorney General Eric Schneiderman's notice says the Trump Foundation has 15 days to file the required documents. The Trump campaign said today in a statement, quote, "While we remain very concerned about the political motives behind AG Schneiderman's investigation, the Trump Foundation nevertheless intends to cooperate fully with the investigation."
Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst is with us in the studio. She has just published a new book called Soup Swap. So not surprisingly, she has brought a bunch of different soups with her. Kathy, welcome back.
Great to be here.
And explain what we're doing here. What is a soup swap?
I'm glad you asked. about 6 years ago, my neighbor and friend Hope Murphy called and said, "I have a great idea to get through the winter. Let's have parties once a month, all winter long. The host will make salad and bread and dessert, and everybody brings a pot of soup. And then at the end of the party, you all go home with six different homemade soups." Hmm. And I don't love potlucks, but I thought, this is a win-win. You bring one pot of soup to a party, you get to go to a party, and then you go home with six different leftovers, and you're not stuck with that same pot of soup. So a soup swap can happen with your yoga club, your book group, in churches, synagogues, with coworkers,
your
anywhere.
Radio show.
Well, this is the first live soup swap. This is a moment. Well, can we take this
good
in?
Good job,
and,
guys.
And we had a number of people that work on the staff here at Here and Now put together some soups.
They're so
also
awesome.
You brought in a soup
I did.
Of your
so
own.
So let's just dive right. Let's start with mine, not because it's mine, but because it might be the lightest. So mine is the roasted fall vegetable soup. And this is an interesting technique. You take every fall vegetable you can get your hand on, butternut squash, pumpkin, leeks, carrots, garlic, shallots, use all of them, use some of them, and you roast them at a very high temperature so they begin to caramelize, and then you throw them into a pot of vegetable stock or chicken stock, and the sweetness of those roasted root vegetables, it's kind of a winning soup, if I do
delicious.
Say so. And then I swirled a little bit of a chive pesto in there. Garnishes and toppings, as you're going to find with all these soups, can make a world of difference. Next, we have director Dean Russell made a soup with his wife Michelle Martin. This
who, by the way, is not the Michelle Martin who hosts
no relation.
Weekend All Things Considered.
There are too many
different.
Michelle Martins. This is a green lentil soup with a curried brown butter, and they adapted that. Many people, the thing about soup is that it's so hugely adaptable. All the recipes in my new book, I'm hoping people will use as a foundation and tweak it the way they like. They found this recipe in Heidi Swanson's Supernatural Every Day. Isn't that fabulous?
Yeah, you've got a pretty multi-talented staff here.
I know.
Dean and I are going to Colorado to do some election coverage.
And
now
eat.
We know
right.
He's going to have to make some soup when we get there.
That's right. All right, moving along. Mary Dew, also on staff, made from my book, a late fall vegetable ramen using udon noodles. And it's in a miso ginger broth. Mm. And she added shiitake mushrooms. She added a little bit more chili oil. And she said, and several people said to me, "Oh, I hope you don't mind I did this or I tweaked it this way." To me, that's a compliment. Mm-hmm. It means they understood the recipe, but they knew what they wanted in the final taste. That's the sign of a great cook. And then the last soup, Julia Corcoran, made a green chili pozole with chicken, and she found that recipe on Epicurious and tweaked it in various ways. Also fabulous. Isn't that so
wow.
good? I know.
And she did that because both she and I have New Mexico connections.
Is
and
that
you've
why
gotta
she did
put
it?
New Mexico green chili. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, it's true. She put New Mexico green chilies in and she pleased the host and Jeremy's happy and all is right with the world. So we're good. But for a moment, I just want to say that since this book's come out, I've had all these people say to me, I really need this book right now. And I say, what do you mean by, I mean, I'm thrilled, but what do you mean by that? And I'm not going to get wildly political, but I will say that this is a very anxious time. This election is bringing out a lot of anxiety. When 9/11 happened, cookbook publishers rushed to publish comfort food books. And I feel that something similar may be going on right now. There is a very unsettled feeling about the election.
Everybody
we'll leave
just
it at
wants
that.
To sit in their living room with the fire on and just curl up with a cup
eat
of soup
and
or 10
soups,
cups of soup.
Or invite their friends and neighbors over and have the joy of sharing food with people and for just a moment forget about the election.
And we're going to put all of these recipes up at our website, hereandnow.org, as we always do. Kathy, do you have a favorite soup?
Oh, it's, you know, like, do I have a favorite child? No, I don't. It depends on the season. I cook very locally and very seasonally. It changes all the time. I made a mulligatawny soup from the book this weekend, and I'm like, this is it. This is my favorite. Then I made this late roasted vegetable soup, and I'm like, no, this is it. You just want to really focus on what's local, what's fresh. And I also just want to say that there are a lot of recipes in the book for side dishes and garnishes and toppings. These are really clever little quick recipes, making croutons from polenta, gluten-free, making quick avocado crema or salsas, or just chopping herbs, things that highlight the flavor of the soup. And I also have a whole chapter on stocks, which scares the bejesus out of people.
The heart of almost any soup.
And
right?
I just want to say you can do it. I have a bunch of recipes in there that I call recycled stock, where after you've had a chicken or a turkey, you use the carcass, you don't throw it away, you make a beautiful stock, or you save all your peelings from your vegetables all week and make a vegetable stock.
The book is called Soup Swap, and you can find the recipes to the soups we've been talking about today at hereandnow.org. Kathy Gunst, Here and Now resident chef, thanks as always.
Thanks. Time to get your soup on.
I know.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Going to eat more soup. This is Here and Now.